Good afternoon and welcome to the August meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. I'd like to give a special welcome to our public radio audience, reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. I'm George Look, the new president of the forum. Mac DeFord, who led the forum for over 17 years, decided recently to give up the presidency, and I am pleased that our board of directors has chosen me to replace him. I think all of us will join me in thanking Mac for his leadership of the forum for those many years. The forum was founded in 1983 and is now in its 35th year of monthly meetings, featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of foreign affairs and U.S. diplomacy. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. The Midcoast Forum is honored to have Jennifer G. Cook speaking to us today on U.S. interests in Africa, making the case to the Trump administration. Jennifer Cook is the director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., where she leads research and analysis on political, economic, and security dynamics in Africa. She is a frequent writer and lecturer on U.S.-Africa policy and provides briefings, testimony, and policy recommendations to U.S. policymakers, the U.S. Congress, and the U.S. military. She also is a frequent commentator in print, on radio, and on television. Jennifer's recent projects include the examination of militancy and extremism in the Sahel and the Lake Chad Basin, religious authority in the state in Africa, energy trends in sub-Saharan Africa, and the launch of the conference series Spotlight on Africa. Jennifer travels widely in Africa and has been an election observer in the Sierra Leone, Mali, Nigeria, and Ghana. Growing up, she lived in Cote d'Ivoire and the Central African Republic, as well as in Belgium, Italy, and Canada, so she's a well-traveled person even at a young age. Prior to joining the Center for Strategic and International Studies, she worked at the National Academy of Sciences in the Office of Human Rights and in the Office of News and Public Information, and in the U.S. Congress on the House Subcommittee on Africa. She holds a Master of Arts degree in African Studies and International Economics from the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies and a Bachelor of Arts degree in Government, magna cum laude, from Harvard University. It is my pleasure to welcome Jennifer Cook to the Mid-Coast Forum.
Thank you so much, and it really is a pleasure and an honor to be speaking here at the Mid-Coast Forum. Just listening to the speakers coming up, Juan Cole, Mike McFaul, it's a little bit daunting to be here. But I'm going to talk today about kind of U.S. policy interests towards Africa from where I sit in a think tank in Washington, D.C. I have to say it's been a tough year for Africa policy pundits in Washington. Africa is never particularly high on the policy radar in a transition period, and this administration has had a particularly tumultuous transition period. But even in other transitions, for example, under the Bush administration, where expectations for Africa policy were fairly low, I mean, he far, far exceeded them, but Colin Powell had traveled to 5 African countries in the first 4 months of the administration. Under Obama, President Obama traveled to Ghana in the first 5 months. So there was movement, and you had some sense of where the administration was thinking on African policy issues. I think what's really notable right now is that there has just been radio silence on what an Africa policy might look like. There have been no real substantive discussions on this. The most concrete indication we have is the budget that was proposed by the White House, which proposes 30% cuts in both the State Department budget and USAID, which could be devastating for a lot of the programs that have been ongoing in Africa. I talked to a lot of people visiting from embassies, from African countries, from European, from Asian countries, Africa watchers thinking what is going to be happening. I think a lot of them are postponing visits by high-level policymakers in their own countries because they don't know who yet to plug into. Just being named senior director at the White House, former CIA analyst, very smart guy, but hasn't had, for obvious reasons, much of a public profile, so we don't know too much about where he's coming from. There's no assistant secretary of state being named as yet, and so we just don't have an idea of kind of where this might go. The chairman of the African Union came to visit in April. He was going to meet with Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. There was a schedule bungle at the State Department, and he ended up not meeting with anyone and traveled back home. Kind of a symbolic snub that could have been an easy win, but instead was a fumble. So the challenge for people like me is to how best to make the case to administration that clearly has many other priorities. How do you make the case that Africa matters, that U.S. interests there are important, and they're only likely to rise in the coming decades, and that there are costs incurred and opportunities lost if the U.S. doesn't engage, and if there's a gap in U.S. engagement with Africa? So there's major shifts in Africa that are going to affect U.S. interests in the coming years, and a gap in engagement means that we miss a lot of that. Well, generally, it's helpful to me. There's no such thing as a fixed U.S. interest in Africa, because interests really are very much in the eye of the beholder in a lot of ways, and a matter of perception. But I think over time, there have been three broad categories of U.S. interests in Africa and pretty much in all parts of the world. The first set are pragmatic considerations of direct interests. Those have, you know, most immediately the security of U.S. citizens and assets, but larger global security issues as well. Economic interests of, you know, jobs and exports and creating markets and trade and investment and so forth. The second set of interests is more a values-based. So promoting U.S. values abroad of democracy, human rights, some of the global norms in terms of international relations, humanitarian assistance to those in poverty or in crisis, health investments, for example, massive investment in combating HIV/AIDS in Africa. And then the third set of interests is kind of the sphere of influence set, which has less to do really with the direct U.S.-Africa relationship, but more with U.S. leadership in the world. So global alliances, and Africa has 54 countries that have a significant weight in multilateral institutions. It has to do with U.S. alliances on global norms, on global issues like climate change or trade or nuclear proliferation and so forth, global governance institutions. These three spheres obviously interconnect and overlap in important ways. So investments in HIV/AIDS also have big impacts for U.S. leadership in the world, for example. And they vary in emphasis depending on what's happening in the United States, what's happening in the global geopolitical context, and what's happening in Africa. But usually they are all three have been present to some extent. In the Cold War, the emphasis was much more on the spheres of influence, where Africa became a proxy battleground for much bigger battles that were being fought with the Soviet Union. In the Clinton administration, a much greater focus on the values-based agenda, humanitarian interventions, democracy promotion. That was the time that South Africa emerged, was liberated as the Berlin Wall fell, and so forth. But overall, the general trend over time, and this is certainly true from the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, and the Obama administration, is that U.S. understanding of its interests in Africa has grown bigger and wider and more expansive, a perception that U.S. interests are rising and becoming more multifaceted. And I think the fear with the Trump administration, or the worry with the Trump administration, is that we're likely to see a dramatic narrowing and a shortened time horizon, a narrowing of what is perceived as within U.S. interests, and a much more transactional, tactical approach to Africa rather than a strategic approach. It's very easy to kind of generalize about Africa. It is 54 states of varying size. You've got a Nigeria at 185 million versus a Botswana at 3 million. Economic clout, the economies are vastly different, political structures, histories, and so forth. Modern maps don't do justice to the size of Africa, because Africa kind of gets scrunched down into the southern hemisphere there. But you'll see China, India, Western Europe, Eastern Europe, Japan, the United States, all collectively are about the landmass of Africa. So you're talking about a huge continent with major diversities. This means that there's no kind of single narrative that works for Africa, and there's no single U.S. interest there or a single policy that can really encapsulate the continent. But what I thought I'd talk about is generally four areas of engagement and development within Africa that I think are worth talking about. Each one of these could probably take a lecture of its own. So I'll just go into each, talking a little bit about some of the priority headlines and issues to watch. These areas are the security and the counterterrorism agenda, economic growth and the U.S. trade and investment agenda, the social change and governance aspect in Africa, and then humanitarian crises. On the security agenda, first and foremost, I think within the U.S. perceptions of interest has been the terror threat. And Africa has become increasingly a place, a new front in global terror groups. And groups like ISIL and Al-Qaeda, through proxies, are gaining a much stronger foothold in Africa than I think many people really had expected. There are kind of four nodes of this right now in Somalia, the group Al-Shabaab, still creating havoc against a very fragile government in Somalia, links to Al-Qaeda. You have Boko Haram in northeast Nigeria that has extended its reach into the country surrounding, so in Chad, in Niger, in Cameroon. More deadly in 2015 than was ISIL, in fact, in the world. And now resorting to tactics that include an increasing use of child suicide bombers, and particularly girl suicide bombers. Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, kind of centered in Mali, that created a nationwide crisis in Mali, has expanded, and it's kind of splintered with multiple alliances with different new groups that have kind of spun off from the original Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. And then finally, ISIL and Al-Qaeda with presence in the security vacuum that is Libya right now. All of these groups started with fairly local agendas, so they grew out of local grievances and fights in Mali, extremely local, between tribes, even between clans within the Tuareg, for example. But they have expanded their tactics and expanded their links with international terror groups, and the incentive for both sides, both the international groups and these local groups, will be to deepen those ties, to raise the profile, gain recruits, and maintain their international visibility. Piracy, we don't hear quite so much about it lately, but piracy has threatened U.S. vessels and raised shipping insurance and costs for everybody. What's interesting in the piracy domain is that a lot of the attacks that were happening off the east coast of Africa, off of Somalia, kind of centered in Somalia, have gone down, largely because shippers began to take measures like, you know, don't slow down when you go past Somalia, or, you know, put somebody on watch, or, you know, have a fire hose to tell people. And there is a multinational naval force there. But we've seen a rise in piracy on the west coast of Africa, and that is actually in some ways more deadly than the piracy off the east coast, because they're not after hostages, which the Somali pirates were, but after the cargo and the ships themselves, so oil that they can sell on the black market. Trafficking of all kinds, that trafficking in wildlife has multiple dimensions that make it worth noticing. Wildlife trafficking generates enormous revenues for international cartels that are engaged with this. It is increasingly militarized, so you have these battles with kind of understaffed, under-weaponized rangers with militarized poachers and sophisticated poaching gangs. And at the rate that rhinoceroses are being killed, there's a fairly short path to extinction for rhinos in Africa at this current rate. So it's devastating rhino populations, it's devastating elephant populations, and many of the markets for these are in Asia, where rhino horn has a more expensive street value than cocaine right now. And this is something that has to be combated within Africa, although there has to be much more done on the demand side of the trafficking as well. But it's tragic on a number of fronts: the conservation, the corruption, the illicit funding flows, and then the militarization and kind of co-option of local communities and so forth. Finally, all kinds of other trafficking. Drug trafficking is major. A number of kind of the Latin American cartels have moved some of their operations into West Africa to feed the European market. And those routes that move drugs from the West African coast up through the Sahel up to the north are the same routes that are used to traffic people, to traffic arms. There are interconnections between some of the drug traffickers and some of the terror groups operating out of Mali and Niger. Again, it's a major moneymaker, and it becomes kind of part of this criminal economy. On the east coast of Africa, you'll see heroin coming in from Eastern Asia and up again through Kenya, through Tanzania, and up then to European markets again. Okay, so let's talk about the economic growth. It's a slightly brighter picture, and I think it's important to note that there are big new opportunities, new competitors, because other players besides the U.S. are seeing the opportunities for investment and trade with Africa. And in this regard, I think the U.S. very much needs to step up its game. You've had, since 2000, fairly significant and steady growth rates within Africa. After the 2008-2009 crash, Africa recovered fairly well, and average growth rates of 6 to 7% have been fairly steady. Now, this is not every African country, and there are, you have to look individually at the countries. There are some major growth nodes and some small countries that have huge growth rates. But the general trend has been of economic growth. A lot of that growth is being funded by commodities. So the export of raw commodities, oil, gas, iron, and particularly to China. So China's rise and its kind of going out and its major construction boom has fueled a lot of economic growth in Africa through this commodity boom. And if on this graph you see the red bar that grows larger and larger is China's share of African exported commodities. Now, the Chinese economy has slowed somewhat, and they're moving somewhat out of that heavy construction phase. So, you know, some of the economies that have benefited most from oil and iron exports are hurting a bit right now. But that growth has been fairly steady, and it has opened up new opportunities for diversification if countries get it right. And in fact, a number of countries have fairly successfully begun to diversify. Areas like construction, telecommunications, financial services, manufacturing to some extent have also grown. Nigeria is a case in point where oil went from 34% of GDP in 2002 to now 14% of GDP. Most of the growth in the past decade has been in non-oil sectors. Now, the caveat here is that government revenues are still almost 90% derived from the energy sector. So the downturn in oil prices hit the Nigerian government hard. But the economic base is actually much more diverse. And their challenge will be, how do you capture that through taxes and so forth? Technology has been a huge boon to the African growth surge. And, you know, telecommunications has been the sector to be in this last decade. Mobile penetration went from 2% in 2001. It's now at about 80%. And the uses that mobile phones have been put to in terms of financial services, mobile banking, you know, even agricultural kind of technologies where you can spot check the price of your agricultural goods, you know, health services and so forth. The mobile phone has really been revolutionary for many African states, and in innovative ways that have, you know, because we have other ways of doing it here in the United States, but necessity has been the mother of creativity on the mobile phone front in Africa. Finally, there's a growing consumer class within Africa that I think the U.S. needs to be, you know, keeping an eye on. More and more people are moving into a middle class. It's not the middle class as we would conceive it here, but it is a group, a class of Africans who have much more disposable income than they had in the past. And in some places like Nigeria or Kenya, you really are seeing a broadening middle class. And that middle class will kind of move from some of the low-end quality goods that China and others have been keen on exporting and is looking for brands and is looking for quality. And the United States is very well positioned to take advantage of that if it is thinking ahead and helping U.S. investors market and raise the profile. It's hard to think of any globally known Chinese brands at this point. I mean, maybe Huawei, maybe a couple of others, but, you know, Levi's, IBM, name hundreds of U.S. brands that are globally known and kind of people want them. The big challenge for this growth going forward is whether African governments can get the infrastructure right. And power and electricity are probably the biggest obstacle for investors going in, but roads, deep water ports, all of those are going to be constraints on what could be, you know, a major growth boom in Africa. And a number of countries are thinking much more strategically about that. Nigeria, it's been a slow road, but it's getting there. Kenya is trying to do some interesting things in northern Kenya with rail and pipelines and ports. China has invested heavily in infrastructure in Africa, and the east coast of Africa is likely to be the tail end of China's Silk Road. And so that whole East Coast and Indian Ocean basin could be a huge hub of new trading patterns and growth in the decades to come. Move on to a next category, which is the social change and governance area. And we're really here, too, at a tipping point that could go either way, but I tend to be an optimist. Africa's population is extremely young. These are pyramids, population pyramids, showing kind of the age distribution of the entire population. You'll see in the U.S., it's fairly evenly distributed from very young to, as you get up in years, it narrows off. So you have a kind of a pillar. In Africa, you have this very dramatic pyramid where young population is really, look, from 20... let's say under 25 is the vast majority in some places, 75, 80% of the population, and then this dramatic narrowing off. So Africa is one of the youngest continents, and its population is likely to grow dramatically. A country like Nigeria by 2050 will have more citizens than the United States at current rates of growth. By 2050, Africa's population is expected to double. So big demographic shifts happening. A lot of that population is urbanizing, and cities in Africa are growing extremely quickly. People are migrating from rural areas, and then just the growth within cities is enormous in itself. You know, this creates a lot of opportunities. Cities have been crucial to kind of being an economic engine of innovation and in economies across the world. The concentration of people raises the political clout of citizens. But it also can be risky as well. If services are not provided, if these cities are not prepared to deal, and you may see the kind of expansion of urban slums. But if you've been to Kibera or parts of Lagos, are really pretty difficult living, and a lot of discontent young people living in them who've come to the city for opportunity and find their expectations completely foiled. On a positive note, civil society and people in general are becoming more connected, more sophisticated. Again, cellular phones and internet and social media has connected people in ways that are empowering citizens and putting pressure on governments to reform. And citizens are feeling more empowered. And you've had a number of standoffs. This is in Burkina Faso a few years ago, where the president wanted to extend his term in office, and people came out in a place where there had not been a whole lot of public protests, and eventually the president had to flee the country. In Angola, where you're actually seeing the elections are today, you've seen in the last few years protests over housing, over teaching, over water, veterans protesting in a place that was very carefully controlled by the government. So kind of unprecedented levels of protests. And in fact, what I'm hearing from some Angolan friends is that the opposition is expected to do quite well in Angola, possibly the two opposition groups taking a majority in the legislature, which is pretty amazing, although the ruling party will keep the presidency. There's no doubt about that. The flip side of all this good momentum is that governments are beginning to push back. And you've seen it partly goes with the kind of decline of the democratic ideal globally, but governments are pushing back with very restrictive media laws that criminalize certain kinds of reporting, civil society laws that say you can't operate if you get any funding from outside sources, these broad counter-terror laws that encompass any kind of criticism of the government. And so they're doing it through these democratic, quasi-democratic legal ways of, you know, passing laws, but the fundamental intent is to push back on democratic pressure. Here you have a number of the leaders who have been there. It's Obiang in Equatorial Guinea, who's been there for 38 years. Seveni in Uganda for 29 years. Dos Santos, this is his last day as president in 38 years. And President Mugabe is 37 years. Rwanda Kagame has been there many years as well. There are a number of these very long-term big men who have shut out the possibility of a younger generation kind of taking over. And there's an increasing trend of pushing back against the Western values of democracy. This is Museveni and religious leaders signing a very draconian bill prohibiting homosexual behavior or promotion of a homosexual lifestyle, which very broadly defined. And in a number of places saying, look, we don't want the American style of civil liberties. We have other models we can turn to. And so a lot of African governments will cite the Singapore model or China, growth without the civil liberties. And, you know, we're willing to sacrifice civil liberties for economic growth can be a compelling argument, although I think in real terms it doesn't necessarily work that way, and people will always be ambitious for greater say in their political life. The health humanitarian front, there are a lot of things going on, the famines in Somalia, in Yemen as well, although that's not in Africa, but in northeast Nigeria, in Sudan, and Somalia, really devastating present. The Congress actually pledged significant support on that, but also recurrent food crises across southern Africa, across the Sahel. Infectious disease, HIV/AIDS still remains a major threat. We saw with Ebola how failure to invest in health infrastructures happened in Liberia, Guinea, Sierra Leone, three of the weakest states, can have really direct impact on the United States when people traveling to the United States with the possibility of spreading the virus. Poverty remains obviously an enormous challenge, and conflict and the potential of genocide is right now being raised in the Central African Republic. Sudan has been in a devastating humanitarian situation since the government kind of essentially devolved into the civil war. So these are all still very compelling, and they will continue to be crises. They change over time, but the fact is poor governance, poor economics, growing populations, growing pressures on resources means that they will be with us for a long time. So the challenge for us in think tank world is making the case to this administration that all of these things, governance, humanitarian, security, the economic growth, they are all interlinked. And you can't have success in one of these areas unless you invest in all the others. And it requires long-term investments in these things. So that is the case we're trying to make. Framing U.S. interests as to redound to U.S. interests, you have to think a little bit longer term and a little bit more strategic. Africa matters, and the continent's global importance and impact is only going to grow. Africa can't be seen through a single prism of security or economics or humanitarian crisis. You have to address these in a coordinated way. There's a much more competitive playing field and a lot of other actors. China's the big one, but Russia, Brazil, Turkey, Malaysia, a lot of other countries, Saudi Arabia, Oman, currently have kind of a political battle, are looking for influence as well. And U.S. disengagement could entail big costs. You know, it's not without champions. And one of the pleasures of working on Africa is that it's not being prone to these divisive bipartisan battles. And that makes my job a lot easier. And you have strong champions for Africa and investment in Africa in Congress on both the House side and the Senate side, on both the Democrat side and the Republican side. And so that kind of gives me hope. You know, they will likely push hard back on the president proposed budget. the private sector. More and more companies are seeing the opportunities, and they want the U.S. to be engaged diplomatically to make sure that there's, you know, they're getting the same kind of support and advantage that companies from other countries are. The faith-based community has always had an important interest in Africa. They help move the HIV/AIDS investment along, the debt relief. Right now, the anti-apartheid movement was, you know, the churches were a huge part of that. You have public health and science partnerships that are going, and more of those kind of people-to-people connections, I think, is really important. Universities, cultural ties. The U.S. has a big opportunity because many Africans still see an affinity with the United States for the TV shows, for the music, for the idea of opportunity. And it's something that I think the U.S. does not want to squander, that general affinity for the dynamism of American culture and education and science and so forth. These are a few of the initiatives on Africa that have been kind of institutionalized, and Congress has given them bipartisan support. So we're not going to see Africa just vanish from U.S. policy, but it will require leadership. So it does have champions, and I do also hope that I can count the Mid-Coast Forum among them. So keep it on the radar screen if at all you can. Thank you for listening, and I hope the administration will listen as well. So.
Very much. I, like many people who've worked international security issues, haven't thought about as much about Africa as I think we all should. So it's nice to have a very coherent and comprehensive presentation like you've given us today. We're going to be collecting questions, but I have a couple here that I'd like to start with. One is that since the whole continent has a 4% growth rate, are there some countries that are doing better than others? Which one? And is there a particular country or region in sub-Saharan Africa that we should focus on? Or is, you know, are the, you keep emphasizing the fact that it's not a single entity.
Right.
You know, is there an area we should focus on, or all of them?
Well, it depends on the issue. If you're looking at kind of where the growth and dynamism will be, you know, you cannot avoid Nigeria, where the demographics has an internal market, its size and clout in the region, its resources, not just oil, but it has other resources as well. You have to engage Nigeria. And if Nigeria goes badly, you'll have West Africa will be going badly as well. And so on a lot of different levels, Nigeria is important to watch. They just had 2 years ago an election in which the incumbent and the incumbent party was voted out. So it was a huge kind of step forward in democracy. They have major challenges with Boko Haram and some of the ethnic and kind of violence in the Niger Delta, the oil-producing Niger Delta. But I'm fundamentally optimistic about Nigeria, where there is huge innovation happening. You don't always see it in the national headlines, but if you go to certain states, a lot of dynamism. So Nigeria is one. East Coast, as I said, because of China's investment in infrastructure, countries getting more strategic about infrastructure. Kenya, I think, is something to watch. Tanzania. Mozambique has just come in, you know, has found globally significant amounts of natural gas. And so if those countries kind of get it right, they can really surge in the next decade. And South Africa, you know, second largest economy, or has the most sophisticated economy and banking sector and so forth. It's right now and kind of bumbling along, not very well. But, you know, with the leadership change, again, there are big possibilities for growth. So those are the big nodes of growth and dynamism that I would watch. But to focus solely on those and forget about smaller countries like Cote d'Ivoire is doing quite well, or to not engage in the Sahel, that could have huge costs as well.
We have a number of questions, of course, on China and the role of China in Africa. Let me read some of them,
okay.
And you can respond either individually or collectively, but it's the role of China. Please comment on the effectiveness of multilateral strategy, the U.S., versus a bilateral strategy, which is China, as it relates to Africa. From China's point of view, have their investments on the continent yielded tangible results in terms of influence, trade, and alliances? China's influence in Africa seems to be increasing steadily. What should the U.S. be doing to maintain or increase our influence? And then just a few of the many questions on China.
Yeah, China has had already significant impact on Africa in terms of commodity boom was driven a lot by demand from China. And the investments that went along with that into rail and roads and ports and so forth. Now, there's a lot of anxiety in the United States early on because China is interfere in internal politics. And so oftentimes kind of deals were made with very authoritarian leaders. Very few of the kind of benefits went to kind of the African citizen. Now, I think some of that was exaggerated. I think on the whole, you have to say that China has been a net boon for African economies. But it depends on where you sit as well. Textile workers in South Africa, where textile was kind of a burgeoning industry, were completely wiped out by the inflow of Chinese textiles. In a lot of the markets, the cheap kind of bric-a-brac, the flip-flops and the buckets, you know, that might have been sold by a local, you know, Chinese traders are coming in and there's, in some cases, a lot of resentment on that. I think ideologically, a number of African countries are saying, look, we don't need to worry so much about human rights and democracy. We're looking at the Chinese model, and they're doing pretty well, bringing people out of poverty without a whole lot of fuss about human rights. That is a view. I think there are a lot of costs to ignoring human rights, and I think there will be limits to growth and innovation and dynamism if you have extremely kind of suppressed political rights and so forth and risk-taking. In places like Ethiopia or Rwanda, I think they will see the limits of that. What the United States should do, you know, the United States has not walked away. It's still engaged in a lot more ways than China is. It engages with civil society. It engages with governments. It invests in young people. It has big development plans. Where it's fallen behind is on the investment and trade agenda. Institutions like OPIC, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, the Exim Bank, they've been very controversial in the U.S. But those are the things that help U.S. companies go into more risky places and make the investments. So giving U.S. companies a like boost to go in and make those trade connections so that they can compete with other players like China, I think that's a really important part. China has a massive development bank, that Exim Bank, that helps Chinese companies go in. And you know, those trade and investment ties, I think, are the ones that are going to endure over time. So that's where I think the U.S. really needs to step up its game.
And then to follow up on that, a couple of questions here on the relative role between U.S. government and private. You're saying the balance should be more toward the private sector?
Yeah, but I think the U.S. government has to play a supporting, catalytic, facilitating role to get there. Some of the big companies have been there for a long time, but they have the wherewithal to do the due diligence and the study and figure out the risks and so forth. If you look to a smaller set of mid-sized companies, they need help and guidance from U.S. embassies, from the Commerce Department, from OPIC to make that. Most embassies, European embassies, Chinese embassies, have huge commercial sectors, people who do nothing but help facilitate businesses and so forth. The U.S. has just a handful of commercial service officers in its embassies, and it's just not something that U.S. has emphasized in its formal policy. It's beginning to change, and Congress has been pushing on that in the Trade Africa, in Power Africa, but I think there's a lot further the U.S. could go on that.
So then what's going to happen when the State Department budget gets cut by 30%. How do you think that's going to play out in light of what you think the emphasis should be?
Well, I cannot imagine Congress will go with the budget that was proposed. So that's one thing. Another interesting thing that happened in the budget was that a lot of funds that were development assistance funds were switched over to economic support funds, which is State Department led, and which has much more kind of political objectives than development objectives. And so, I think moving it from the agency that is supposed to specialize in development to a State Department that has other and competing political interests is, I think that was something that got a little bit overlooked in the discussions on the budget. I think particularly for Africa, that you need more diplomacy, not less. The Africa Bureau has always been somewhat underfunded, understaffed, and it is a place where you have the largest number of UN peacekeepers because of conflict. you have conflicts, you have opportunities, and, you know, I think to not have regional expertise and people on the ground and in Washington who are connecting with Africa, it's not going to be devastation, but it's huge opportunities lost.
So while we're sticking on bilateral issues, how about other countries? What's been the role, for example, of India in Africa, or the Europeans?
India is interesting to watch also because its economy is growing and it's been a quieter, kind of less noticed expansion than China has been, but it is also important to watch, particularly in East Africa. You know, there are a lot of kind of connections that date back many decades to East Africa. So it's a quieter engagement, but they are certainly growing. Russia, South Africa under Zuma has kind of signed a memorandum for a massive $1 trillion nuclear power generation deal. It eventually got snubbed, but it's still a possibly a live issue. You know, if Russia is as able to influence Eastern European and even kind of U.S. process of democracy, you could be pretty afraid should they turn their eye to a place like South Africa or Kenya, for example, because of economic interests. Europe is interesting. Britain has pulled back a little bit. I mean, on humanitarian development, it's still safeguarding that. Much lighter military footprint than in the past, whereas France has kind of stepped up in a big way in the Sahel and Central Africa and so forth, but also less engaged than it has been in the past. And interestingly, Germany is becoming more and more interested in Africa, in part, no doubt, because of the migrant issue, and decided that, you know, if you want to deal with the illegal migrant issue, or you have to look to the source and help build the economies in the region. So Germany is thinking a little bit more than it has in the past about Africa, and I think they could be an important leader in that respect.
Now, we have a number of questions related to what you showed us to be the population distribution in Africa and the effect on the economy, the effect on education. Is the development going to be able to keep up with these growing populations, or are they going to see a certain crash here at some point?
Well, that is a big question. I mean, there are the education systems already under strain. That is a place that if I were to invest as an African government or an external partner, how do you build quality education for this growing young population that prepares them for today's economy and the economy of the future? That is when the skills gap is still huge, and so how do you do continuing education, even job training? What are the schools that do kind of the trade instruction is one thing. But then you also have to find better ways to employ population, whether it's in agriculture and expanding into agro-business, whether it's in manufacturing that creates more sustainable jobs. If you want to do those things, though, you have to get the infrastructure and the power sector right. You have to make investments that will make these economies grow, that will then create opportunities for employment. Failure to do that, as water resources and arable land resources are declining, means that you've got greater conflicts, and you're seeing a rise in communal conflicts between herders and farmers, for example. It also means pressures to migrate, and hundreds of young African men take these rickety boats piled high and die on the Mediterranean trying to reach a place for a better chance at life. People know how risky that voyage is, and it is only very dire circumstances at home that drive them to do that. Investments in growing the economy and in education, it could go either way.
And then here's one on the recent Kenyan elections, if you could comment on the results and the prospects.
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, I think a lot of international observers came and say, oh, election day looked great. Uhuru Kenyatta won by a sizable margin. Why is the opposition complaining? I think it goes to some of the deep distrust that has been created in Kenya over the years, over the institutions and the independence of the Electoral Commission, for example, the lack of transparency. And when we thought with the election of Kibaki that in 2003 that maybe some of the ethnic calculus of elections was behind us, But I think we've seen that it is still very much alive within the Kenyan political process, which is troubling. You know, I think it's very easy, and the New York Times did it, what I thought was a terrible editorial on Kenya, kind of Raila Odinga, the perennial loser, he shouldn't complain, take it to the courts, when this was a man that was essentially duped out of an election victory in 2007, 2008. So I think you have to look a little bit at that fundamental distrust that many Kenyans have of the system. This goes to a broader point on democracy, which we tend to think of democracy as the competitive aspect, and are the elections transparent and free and the institutions good? Really at the core of democracy is less the competition than a fundamental consensus within a country that we belong together and we are better losing in the system and staying in it than just picking up our stuff and walking away. And I think still a number of African countries are struggling with that sense of national identity dating from colonial times when borders were done arbitrarily and building that sense of in this together. And I think, you know, our country is going through a similar moment of polarization where it's important to remember that what makes a democracy work is at least some element of consensus that we're all in this together, we'll stick by the rules of the game. That is even more acute, I think, in places like Kenya, where it's always politics has always been seen as zero sum. If this group wins, we lose, rather than we can all negotiate our way forward. And the one thing in Kenya that's interesting, too, is that they had a constitutional change a few years back that devolved a lot of the power that resided in the presidency to governors and to legislative seats. And so that these are these two perennial rivals, Raila Odinga and Uhuru Kenyatta, and their fathers were rivals before them. But what you might see is kind of some of the tension in that very powerful presidency, winner take all, begin to dissipate as governors see we can have a real powerful role at the gubernatorial level, not just at the presidency. So that's a hopeful outlook on that, although it might mean that some of the corruption and the bad practices also then disseminate.
I think we'll take time for a couple more questions here. There are way, way more questions we have time for. And I apologize to people if we didn't get to yours. But this one I had to ask, and that is, what are we and the rest of the world doing to curtail the poaching in Africa?
Yeah, well, you know, this is an area that there was a lot of bipartisan congressional interest in. And Ed Royce, who's chair of the House Subcommittee on Africa, was extremely interested in support for anti-poaching measures and both at the local level and the more international. Jeff Flake, so you had Republicans, you had Chris Coons, you know, in the Senate working on this. And President Obama actually was able to, there was a dialogue with senior leadership in China, which vowed to begin to curtail the market for ivory within China, which has been a major consumer. But I think the continuing to press the importers, and the U.S. has a ways to go on that as well, because we still have we call it antique ivory, we can still trade, but it's very easy to slip new ivory and nobody can tell the difference. But working at that international level and setting norms, awareness, Vietnam right now is the big importer of rhino horn. And I have to tell this story because a Kenyan, he was a governor, came to one of our conferences and we were talking about rhino poaching and so forth. And he said, and they think it's, an aphrodisiac and the ground rhino horn, which is a prestige product in much of Asia. And he says, well, I have to tell you, there is a little blue pill we have now. And he said, we need to distribute that across Vietnam. You know, public awareness raising and that senior level global norm setting, I think, is as important as helping empower the local ranger outfit.
Then a final question. If we all want to get smarter about Africa, can you recommend a book or two or a website that we should be looking at?
That's a tough one. There's a great website called African Arguments, which I like because it is a lot of short essays of analysis on kind of a lot of different breaking events that is, and a lot of the articles are written by Africans. So, you know, I think that's really important. African Arguments is good for news and kind of a glimpse into the African media. All Africa is a great compiler, allafrica.com. And then the Social Science Research Council in New York also has kind of a a blog compiles and edits, you know, very good entries on Africa and essays on Nigeria. They do a lot on Sudan, on Zimbabwe, and so forth. And then there's always the CSIS website, csis.org/Africa.
It's a setup.
And we'll have a busy year ahead, we promise.
All right, and we thank you very, very much.